Content warning. This episode contains references to violence and murder. Please call or visit the hotlines in the description if you need help.
I Murder!
Hey guys, welcome to I Murder, the podcast where Gen Z talks true crime. I'm your host, Jocelyn, and today we have an insane case that I've been dying to cover on this show. Today we're covering the case of the Lipstick Killer. And this case was actually suggested to me by one of our listeners, so I decided to do a little research, and turns out a Criminal Minds Season 4 episode was inspired by this case, and I also found this insanely good documentary on YouTube that was released a few years ago. If you guys want to check that out, I totally recommend it. It'll be in the description of this episode. So without further ado, let's get into it. It was June 5th, 1945 in Chicago, Illinois. A young woman entered her apartment at 4108 North Kenmore Avenue, and in her very home, she was met by a horrific image. It was her mother, 43-year-old Josephine Ross's dead body. Her head was wrapped in a dress, and she had locks of dark hair in her hand. She was found with stab wounds and defensive wounds, meaning she put up a huge fight. At first, the scene looked like it might have been a robbery gone wrong, but taking a closer look, investigators couldn't detect any valuables that might have been taken. This was a cold-hearted, violent murder. Investigators turned to the people closest to Josephine, her husband and every one of her ex-partners, but they were all quickly ruled out for having solid alibis on the night of her murder. A few witnesses came forward during the investigation, stating that there was a dark-haired man who, every so often, stood outside the apartment building, creepily pacing around. And obviously, this grabbed the attention of authorities, but they were never able to find this mysterious creep. It seems like the killer snuck inside Josephine's apartment, catching her by surprise in her own bedroom. Now, this is when medical examiners found a strange detail. After stabbing her to death, the perpetrator washed her body. He also took tape to close her stab wounds and placed a dress over her head. And from a psychological perspective, it looks like he might have displayed some remorse, you know, covering her head so he wouldn't have to see her, washing her body and closing her wounds so he wouldn't have to face what he did. At least to me, it seems like the aftermath of the crime was him trying to make up for what he did. On December 20th, 1945, a cleaning lady for an apartment building noticed something odd. She heard extremely loud radio music coming from one of the apartments, and she decided to check it out. Truly a horror movie moment. I would personally think the worst and run the other way, but this cleaning lady, she's bold. So she follows the sound of the radio and discovers an apartment with its door partly open. There, she found Frances Brown stabbed to death with a knife lodged in her neck. Crime scene investigators found fingerprints on the door jamb of the apartment. It seems like nothing was really sprouted from that, probably because this is the 40s and crime scene technology wasn't fully developed at the time. But that's for now. Just wait a little bit and we'll see what happens with that fingerprint. But not only that, there she found the notoriously eerie message written in lipstick on the wall. That said, quote, "For heaven's sake, catch me before I kill more. I cannot control myself," end quote. This would be considered the first clue investigators discovered to connect a series of murders during this time in Chicago. It isn't fully clear, though, if the killer brought this lipstick with him to the crime scene or if he just grabbed it from the apartment. My bet is on the latter just because his behavior seems really impulsive, and if we're trusting that what the message says is honest, this person is driven by impulse, even to the point where he can't control himself. So honestly, I doubt he'd plan ahead enough to, you know, bring his own lipstick. The third and last victim was found on January 7th, 1946. It was the day after the end of winter break and all the kids in town were getting ready for their first day back to school. Early in the morning, the mother of Suzanne and Betty Dignan went to wake up her two daughters. She woke up Betty, and upon entering 6-year-old Suzanne's room, she released a blood-curdling scream. Suzanne was missing. She immediately called for authorities. The police carefully searched Suzanne's room for anything that might indicate where she had gone, There was no blood, so there was a good chance that she was still alive. And there, crumpled on the floor, they found a note. A ransom note. It read, quote, "Get $20,000 ready and wait for word. Do not notify FBI or police. Bills in fives and tens," end quote. The note is actually written so poorly in regards to grammar. Like, there are so many capitalized letters where capitalized letters shouldn't be, and a lot of the words are misspelled. And if you want to take a look at it for yourself, as well as the message written on the wall in Francis's apartment, you can find it on our Instagram at imurderpodcast. There we have some visuals that you guys can check out. Now, everyone in the community was searching for Suzanne. All hands were on deck. There was a slight possibility that she was still alive, so time was of the essence. Throughout this search, the police department received numerous anonymous phone calls from the same man, demanding the ransom money before quickly hanging up. They were essentially being harassed by this guy, and remember, they didn't have tools to trace phone calls at the time, so they kind of just had to deal with it. The police received an anonymous tip that very day that Suzanne went missing, leading authorities to a local sewer. Suzanne was found, but only her head was found. They then located her leg in a catch basin, her torso in a storm drain, her left leg in another drain. Her arms were found in a sewer months later. The precision in which she was dismembered led investigators to believe that the killer might have been a butcher or had some sort of job that involved cutting meat. I mean, it was clean and there was no sign of hacking. So this guy, he knew what he was doing. All these cruel crimes shocked Chicago police, to say the least. This time was notorious for gang and mafia violence. It was something authorities dealt with all the time, but they never dealt with cases involving cold-blooded murder, especially against little girls like Suzanne Dignan. The term serial killer hadn't even been coined in the US at the time, so, you know, that says a lot. Near the location where Suzanne's head was found was an apartment building. Following procedure, investigators deep searched the building and bingo, they uncovered a basement laundry room with a line of tubs. There were signs that blood was drained in one of the tubs, and although DNA testing was in advance at the time, authorities ruled that this had been the location where Suzanne had been dismembered. Now, at this point, investigators hadn't yet realized that the writing in Francis' wall from the first murder and Suzanne's letter, the ransom letter, was similar. When they did connect them, they realized the writing seemed like when you try to fake your own handwriting, and they both followed the same formula of misplaced capital letters, misspelling, and word choice. It was clear now that they were dealing with several murders committed by the same person. After Suzanne's murder, the police interviewed a ton of people. They had a long list of persons of interest and suspects, but they eventually ruled everyone out. During these interviews, police received a good amount of eyewitness accounts. Two of Dignan's neighbors heard a man speaking around 1 a.m. the same night of the murder. Marianne Klein and Jake DeRosa reported that at 3 a.m. the night Suzanne went missing, they found a man sneaking into the laundry room where Suzanne was dismembered. Something seemed to have startled him, and he then left in a hurry. And several other people in the area reported the same thing. Authorities are led to 65-year-old Hector, a janitor in the apartment building where the Dignans lived. They really thought this was their man, even though there was essentially no evidence that pointed at him. He had no history with being a butcher, so he couldn't have dismembered someone so precisely. The reason why they did arrest him, though, was because they profiled the writer of the crime scene notes to be a dirty man, and Hector happened to be a janitor, which to them was dirty. And this is obviously enraging to me, because how are you going to accuse a man of murder by their occupation? Like, since when has that made any sense? Like, show me the legal documents. It doesn't make sense. They questioned Hector for hours and even beat him physically, dislocating his arm to get anything out of him. It's after hours that they realize that Hector is a Belgian immigrant and barely spoke English, let alone write it. So obviously, he couldn't write that note in Suzanne's room or on the wall in France's apartment. I mean, if you want to know how bad the authorities could mess up, just look at this example. This is bad. You don't beat someone up to get a confession out of them, and then hours later, realize that they obviously can't be the perpetrator because they barely speak English. Thank God, Hector and his family sued the police and received a total of $20,000 in return for everything they had to go through. Though personally, I don't think, you know, like, trauma has a price, but I mean, it's something. It's clear that at this point, the police were desperate to pin the murders on anyone. They just wanted to tell the public that they got their man. The problem was they couldn't find anyone who they could concretely convict. Until 6 months later. On June 26, 1946, the authorities made their last arrest in this case. The person arrested was 17-year-old William Arams. He was born on November 15, 1928 in Evanston, Illinois. He had a pretty normal childhood, at least for the time. Despite having a record of petty theft, there was no indication of violent behavior. He did grow up around the time of the Depression, so of course his family had been poverty-stricken, but there was no history of trauma that most serial killers usually have. He was very intelligent, he never picked a fight, and never really had any problems with anyone. His only real big issue was his addiction to stealing, which he had been arrested for on several counts and even sent to a correctional school in Indiana. The day of his arrest, William had been hunting to rob a new place. You know, he had a date that night and he didn't have any money, so he was looking for some cash to grab. And where did he decide to do that? In the same neighborhood as the Dignan residence. Police immediately arrest him and take him into custody. They later announced to the public that they found William's fingerprints on Suzanne's ransom note. They found the lipstick killer. During his questioning, they made William write on a piece of paper what was written on the ransom note. And let me just tell you now, they can't be any more different. Seriously, we have it posted on our Instagram and there's no way that they share any similarities. Like, you can take a look for yourself. The killer's handwriting is rounder, thinner, compared to William's handwriting, which is small, dark, and thick. But alas, according to the police, it was a perfect match. Which, damn, they do not have 20/20 vision then. 2 weeks later, after William's arrest, the police released to the public a statement that not only were William's fingerprints found on the ransom note, they were also found on the door jamb to Francis's apartment. So they were linking those two murders together and bringing it back to William. After a month of being arrested, William confessed to the murders of Josephine, Francis, and Suzanne. This is when transcripts of the police interviews with William were released to the public. Most of his answers to their questions were straight to the point, and he always claimed his innocence, stating that he only knew as much as the newspapers he had read on the murder cases. However, at one point, he pleaded guilty for a plea bargain, meaning he would serve 3 life sentences in prison instead of being sent to death row. After his confession, William clung to his innocence. He stated on numerous occasions that the only reason he confessed was because he had no other choice. His confession, though, was enough for the authorities, and believe it or not, there was no trial. William was sent straight to prison. His first week in prison, William was barely given any food to eat or any water to drink. He wasn't even allowed to speak to his lawyer. The only thing he was allowed to do was visit the prison hospital for his head injury. And you must be thinking, hey, Jocelyn, how did William get his head injury? Well, naturally, during his arrest, there was some resistance. And you want to know what the police did in response to his resistance? One of the officers grabbed a stack of flower pots and smashed it into his head, rendering him unconscious. Not only will that piss you off, but the authorities gave William a polygraph test. One that they state resulted as inconclusive. However, years later, those results were looked over again and they were concluded as innocent. You know, I have a checklist right here with me and I just keep checking off reasons why I should detest the Chicago police in the 40s. During his time in prison, William focused on learning. He was the first prisoner in Illinois to receive a college degree and received a ton of certificates for being a model prisoner. He spent a lot of his time in the prison library, reading books on criminal justice and the judicial system. It was like he was soaking all this information up just to have a better understanding of what he was experiencing. It even got to a point where the other prisoners knew William as the guy to go to when you have a trial coming up, especially since he would advise his fellow inmates on what to say, how to behave, like in court, etc. Now, let's look over the inconsistencies within the evidence that is tied to William. The main thing that implicated William to the murders were the fingerprints, the ones in the ransom notes and the ones in the door jamb. When it came to the ransom note, before William was arrested, authorities said that there were no fingerprints on the note. But after his arrest, suddenly, it seemed like these fingerprints appeared out of nowhere. When police were first asked about William's fingerprints on the ransom note, they stated that there were two fingerprints on the front of the note. But years later, they state that there were three, including one in the back of the note. So clearly, there are a lot of inconsistencies with what the police were saying. Now, something that's really weird about these fingerprints is the way they're found on the ransom note and door jamb. They were literally found perfectly in place, just like when you dip your finger in ink and place it on a fingerprint sheet. It looks like they got his fingerprint on file and framed him. And this is a pretty easy thing to do. You know, I looked it up, and I can't even believe you can find this kind of information online. But all you need is cellophane tape, right? And a fingerprint. So you get cellophane tape, you get that piece of tape, and you put it on top of a fingerprint on file. Then you lift the tape, and then you place that tape wherever you want, and boom, the fingerprint is on a crime scene, you know? So they could have easily framed this. The other evidence is the handwriting. The police state that the handwriting is identical to the killer's. However, every single handwriting specialist that has looked over this case has stated that they are indeed not the same. They're not the same handwriting. On March 5th, 2012, William Hyrums passed away at 83 years old from diabetes. Today, most lawyers look at this case and immediately categorize it as a clear wrongful conviction. It's one thing being a thief since childhood, it is a complete other thing to dismember a little girl. If William was actually innocent, that means the lipstick killer was never caught. A part of me also believes that we might be dealing with different killers here. The authorities might have just wanted to group these murders together to not have to deal with several killers. I mean, if we look at Suzanne's murders compared to the other two that we discussed, they're vastly different. The MO, the victimology, and the disposal are all different. The only thing that really ties all these murders together is the handwriting and the fingerprints. Quote-unquote fingerprints, because they could have easily been, you know, placed there. So that just, like, really keeps you thinking, you know? Personally, I think William was innocent, and it's hard to say who exactly was a lipstick killer just because there's so many theories online, but there aren't any, like, concrete answers. I do want to know, though, what you guys think. Do you think William was innocent? Do you think all these crimes were tied together, or do you think they were just completely different ones? And if you know a little bit more about this case, who do you think the lipstick killer is? You can leave your theories in our recent post on our Instagram based on this episode. If we're going by the idea that William was innocent, this case is really hard to cover then, because that means that there are three victims and their families that never received justice. And it's just hard to even consider that someone spent their entire life in prison from 17 years old to 83 years old. On the bright side, he did make the most of it. He spent a lot of his time studying, like we covered. But it is definitely difficult to know that there are a lot of people who are in prison today who don't deserve to be imprisoned. I know that there are a lot of organizations that advocate for innocent prisoners, and we can actually link those in the description if you guys want to go and support them. Other than that, this is the end of our case. But that's not the end of this episode. We do cover a special segment every guestless episode where we read your I Survived stories. And this week, we actually have a very special one sent in by one of our listeners named Luciana. And let me read this over for you guys. This is a very interesting story. It says, "Hey Jocelyn, I'm a big fan of your podcast and I wanted to share this story. So I live in Costa Rica, and here we have a place called Avenida Escazú. It's basically like an open mall that has apartments. So one Friday, I was there with my friends, and one of my friends left with a boy and went into the apartments. Me and my other friends saw some guys follow them, so we got scared and followed them. We were in the 7th floor, and we knocked on one of the doors. This old man answered the door, and we asked if he knew if the boy lived around here, and he said he didn't know. Then he started saying that he hadn't seen anyone, and if we had a lost boy, he could help. Then he proceeded to tell us we could go into his apartment to check it out. When I looked inside his apartment, it was completely empty. He had no furniture, nothing. We then told him it was fine and that we had to leave. He then started following us through the corridor and saying that he was a doctor, that if someone was hurt, he could help. Then we saw some people we knew, so we waved at them and ran to them like if we were meeting them. We were so scared. We left the apartments and called our friends like 1,000 times so she could come out. She came out of the apartments and said everything was okay and nothing happened to her. I was so scared. I never told my parents or anyone really, and I haven't gone into those apartments ever again. And that's the end of the story. Well, Luciana, that was a great story. Obviously terrifying. I can't even imagine what was going through your head while you were trying to just get your friend some help. But thank you again for turning in that story. And I'm glad that you're safe, that your friends are safe. And if you guys want your I Survived story to be featured on our podcast, you can send in your emails at our Gmail, imurderpodcast@gmail.com. And you might have an opportunity to be featured in our episode. But other than that, that is the end of this episode. Thank you guys so much for listening. You guys can catch us on all major podcast streaming sites like Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. And always remember to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts so we can get more people listening in on these true crime cases. Follow our Instagram at iMurderPodcast if you want to get some visuals on this. And also, we have a Discord if you guys want to join in and discuss these cases with each other. That'll be linked in the description below. And as always, you can't be a hottie if you're a dead body. Bye! See you next Friday! This episode was written, produced, edited, and hosted by Jocelyn Martinez. Music by Kaylee Fermin.